stand order. We have several things on the agenda today, and we'll start out this meeting with Senator Bundy, Senator Hoffman, Senator Dyson, Senator Stedman, Co-Chair Wilkin, and myself, Senator Green, and Senator Olson. The first thing on the published schedule is Senate Bill 141. Because of some problems getting the ORP provisions for the university program into the bill, we will bring that up first thing tomorrow, and there'll be probably a couple of minor technicals, and we will go from there and be ready to move that out. And we have several people, I think, online about the E91 surcharge, Senate Bill 100, and some people here in the building. And in order to get that heard and testimony out, and so we can get this on its way, I've moved it to the top of the calendar so that we don't keep people online or people in the building for more time than they need to be here. So if we could turn to Senate Bill 100, and you'll be receiving a sort of a memo from my office that staff sent to me outlining the changes that we have requested in this. And this is a result of some of the things that we heard in last year's bill, some requests we had from people in different parts of the state, and and then a couple of items from the drafter. I think sections 4 and 5 are drafter recommendations, so that it applies to I think all municipalities regardless of organization equally, and I think it was probably just an omission. And Jim Rowe is online. We do have version S before us, which is a committee substitute. Senator Wilkin, if I could get a motion, and then
Madam Chair, move to adopt CS for Senate Bill 100, Finance version S, Cook dated 4/4/05, as our working document.
And I will object for purposes of explanation. The Section 1 change, if you follow this page, has to do with the amended to include the enhanced 911 system under home rule applicability. And I think that was also a drafter recommendation. And in Section 2, we reduced the $2 surcharge to $1.50, maintain the election provision. Anytime anything over that requires notification by the municipality or the entity of government when the surcharge is assessed and when it is changed. The reason for that is that in the past, the telephone utility is a group that has borne the responsibility for explaining to their ratepayers after the first bill goes out that they did not increase the rate on their own, that it was a provision under the federal allowed and required statute for E911 or 911 service, that that service charge be passed on to the ratepayer. It also links the 911 surcharge to the federal definitions. There are some requirements there that the feds have in their statute. We want to be sure that that is understood by all our municipalities, that they are staying within those confines and using the funds for the purposes for which they were intended. And requires the borough, in line 29, requires the borough to reimburse the municipality for their expenses first, and that reimbursement shall occur at least every 3 months. And that has to do with the additional PSAP in a service area that where the borough is a primary collector of funds. And they will pay the PSAP first, and then they can start amassing their contribution. And in from last year's bill, we received some interest from some dispatch centers that the Section 3, to include the private branch exchange, PBX, identification to ensure that responders go to the actual location of the caller, which, as we know, is the primary reason for the E911. It's to identify and more closely specify location, as well as, in the 911 service, the phone number. Senator Bundy, would you like to comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill was originally brought to you at request from municipalities that they were required to provide an E911 service that was not funded. And if this iteration of the bill does provide for additional funding, then I think the purpose of their request is achieved. And we have a number of people here that want to testify, and they are better qualified to comment as to whether it achieves the end that they were hoped for than I.
Thank you very much. We do have some people online, and I would prefer to, so it looks like most of these people are questions only, but I'll kind of go through the, Jim Rowe, you are to testify. Could you give your testimony, please, and identify yourself?
I will, Madam Chair. I'm Jim Rowe. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Telephone Association. The Telephone Association has 14 member companies that all serve rural areas of the state of Alaska. First of all, I'd like to thank the Senate, particularly, for an E911 bill that has come out and really has our support. We appreciate very much the attention that's been given, and we'd like to see E911 legislation passed this session. The version S we are looking at today, we are in support of. I'd like to point out, particularly on page 2, on line 12, the amount of $1.50. We appreciate that reasonable reduction from the previous amount. We also appreciate that it's an increase that doubles the amount that's currently allowed. On line 16, it particularly addresses parity in the payment between wireless telephone service and wireline telephone service. That's very important to us because we have in this state competition between wireless carriers and wireline carriers. And we feel like for competitive neutrality, it's important that if one service is required to put an increase on its rate, that a competing service should also have to do that. I point out line 24 on page 2, which is the notice that the chair mentioned. Very important to us as the entity, as telephone companies that are the entity for recovering this money for E911 service, that the customers are aware of the reason for that. And we very much appreciate, even though we will also put notices out, that it will be a responsibility of the municipality to let the customers in that service area know ahead of time the importance and the reason for that increase. On page 3, dealing with the PBXs, this is a real good place for an engineer or two to get with you and confuse issues. And they've tried to do that with me. But in layman's terms, a concern we have on that is that perhaps, well, we know there are PBXs out there right now that they call dumb PBXs as compared to smart, that are able to, are unable to send the location you're looking for. We realize there's a cost either in software upgrade or perhaps in complete replacement of these PBXs. And it might be well to consider that there be some time period rather than just passage of legislation and the decision by a municipality to require this system for the entities that are providing these PBXs. Some are owned by telephone companies and leased to businesses. Some are owned by businesses. They vary in size and they vary in cost significantly. Some time to implement the upgrade might be very much appreciated by those that would have to do it. That said, the Alaska Telephone Association is very much in support of this bill. I'm available to answer questions and help as I may.
Any questions for Jim Rohr? Okay, thank you, Jim, for your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And some of the ARCNET sites are primarily people who for questions only, but I'll ask Daryl Davis, did you have any comment or are you question only?
I would be question only, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Tim Rogers?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Tim Rogers. I'm with the Alaska Municipal League. I haven't seen version S, so I really can't comment specifically, but I can offer a couple of general comments. First of all, we don't have any problem with the notification process of letting the customers, the telecommunications customers, know that the increase is because of action that the municipality took. That's certainly a reasonable thing to do. We're concerned about a further decrease from $2 to $1.50. We think that $2 is a more reasonable number based on some of the local governments. But overall, it looks like it's something that we can live with. Be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions for Tim Rogers with the Alaska Municipal League? Thank you, Tim.
Thank you.
Don Savage. Matsu or Wasilla.
Yes, I'm here, Madam Chair. Thank you very much. Questions only, but basically, I think we're in support of the bill as it's written and appreciate the work the Senate has done on this.
Thank you, Don. Hope all's going well there.
It is.
Thank you.
Windy day.
Okay. Bill Duo in the room.
Good morning. My name is Bill Doolittle. I'm the contract project manager for the Municipality of Anchorage 911 system, and I'm proud to say I was an Alaska resident for 25 years. So I appreciate the opportunity to testify this morning on SB 100. Available mostly for comments, there are two pieces of the language in the bill that we think are going to provide significant impediments to 911 programs within the state. The first one begins on page 2. About line 26, where a municipality may only use the enhanced 911 surcharge for phase 1 and phase 2 enhanced 911 services as described in 47 CFR 2018. The problem we see with that specific Code of Federal Regulations, in fact the first sentence of that section says this only applies to wireless carriers. So we believe upon reading it, this would effectively block us from using 911 surcharge monies for even a basic 911 system within the state. When you build a 911 system, you start with basic 911, which is merely the ability to dial 911 and have somebody answer the phone 24 hours a day. You go to enhanced 911, where you actually get the telephone number and the address of the caller. And then on top of that, you build wireless phase 1 capability, which is the address of the cell site, and wireless phase 2 capability, which is the latitude-longitude of the handset. So basic and enhanced 911 are the building blocks of a 911 system. The second significant issue begins about line 28 on page 2, where it talks about reimbursement to municipalities within a program area, where it says fully reimburse each city within the borough before the surcharge may be used for other expenses of the enhanced 911 system. There are necessarily some area-wide types of expenses that must be put in place before any primary public safety answering point begins to take 911 calls. Foremost of these is the database management piece, and this is where we aggregate the subscriber records from all the carriers so that we now have that location for an enhanced 911 system. This is generally a super jurisdictional area sort of responsibility. Normally 911 programs will do that for the benefit of a number of municipalities. These tend to be fairly permanent costs. Once you've incurred the one-time startup fee, there's monthly charges that are associated with the maintenance of those records. And that pretty much continues in perpetuity. Also, the trunking and circuits that go to the primary PSAPs. Again, these would come from each of the carriers to the primary PSAP. If you have multiple PSAPs, then you may have an opportunity to say, well, we do have municipal specific expenses, but they would be equally reimbursable to all municipalities or a borough 911 center. What we might offer as an alternative, and we've discussed this at the local level with many agencies, is that we can actually determine the precedence of costs. As I mentioned, some of the database costs, infrastructure costs, technology costs, which tend to be less if you aggregate them among agencies. And then as you work your way down your surcharge revenues, you can actually start to reimburse for some of the call taking and operational costs of the 911 program. The challenge that you've heard for many weeks now is that the current surcharge rule doesn't allow reimbursement for many of those costs, and many 911 programs are operating at a deficit because the surcharge is not adequate. Those are substantially my comments. I'm available for questions or clarification if you have any.
Okay. On what would be necessary for us to, because our purpose here is to remind everyone who is the collector of these funds and is a recipient of these funds that they have a specific use. And we're trying to talk about the use as defined in federal law that allowed the collection of these funds. So what would be the correction to this language? Do you have any suggestions?
Madam Chair, the first trick is that when we talk about carriers, there's actually two classes of carriers. Local exchange carriers are regulated at the state level. Wireless carriers are regulated by the FCC. So there's really two sets of rules about surcharges and collections. The federal government has allowed each state to set up their own 911 program. So we essentially have 50 911 state statutes for 911 programs. And again, within the U.S., these are all unique. In fact, as a little factoid, when we talk about parity for surcharges, there's actually 27 states that have different surcharges for wireless and wireline carriers. So really, when we get down to a state level, it's whatever your statute directs or allows, and in particular in Alaska, what a local level 911 program would be. One of the challenges in working with a number of municipalities and boroughs within the state is getting that interlocal agreement about the scope of services and the scope of a 911 program. Current statutes provide wide latitude for a municipality, once it elects to collect the surcharge, to create the scope of that program. Many municipalities and boroughs are challenged to come up with written agreements that specify those details about the roles and responsibilities and the allocation of surcharges. We think on a statewide basis, we could suggest a priority of those costs just based on the reality of how you make those expenditures, but really the needs and the configuration of dispatch centers within a borough or a municipality, we feel is a local selection. The public safety agencies get to choose who will dispatch for them. This leads us into that discussion about 911 call taking versus radio dispatch and service area responsibilities, but I don't want to go down that path. I believe if given a little bit of time, we could recommend to the committee some alternative language. But I'm not sure we want to delay the bill. I think that you'll find that there is great support for the bill as written today. Just the caution about the language and some of the challenges it may create.
Well, I would rather see it corrected before it leaves here than to, you know, have something flawed that has any kind of, you know, problem such as you're talking about. And what was your second item? It was lines what?
Beginning line 28 for the reimbursement to the municipalities.
CFR. Okay, and then what was the second one?
The first one was tying the use of the surcharge to phase one and phase two based on 47 CFR 2018.
Okay, the first one was the phase one and phase two.
Yes,
race,
ma'am.
Okay? That's it. And the second one is?
Reimbursement to municipalities as a priority.
Oh, thank you, thank you, thank you. Okay, do you understand, again, do you understand the problem we're trying to address here?
Madam Chair, I believe I do. Again, working with a number of municipalities and boroughs, there is a question of program scope and accountability to municipalities within boroughs. Not all 911 programs hold monthly, quarterly, annual meetings. The scopes of many programs are not published and explicit. It would be very easy to have that requirement. It's very simple and straightforward to do that on a local level.
How do we handle that in statute?
I beg your pardon?
How do we handle that in statute?
Just shooting from the hip. Have a requirement that a 911 program explicitly document the scope of the program and reimbursement to agencies. That really sets the groundwork that says if an agency does have a bona fide request for reimbursement, there's a mechanism that the program needs to address it.
Excuse me.
We'll take a brief adies. We're going to probably go ahead and continue one other person or a couple other people to testify, and then we're going to send staff and people aside with experts to figure out the language we're trying to shoot for so that we end up with a good product. Senator Wilkin has a question he would like to get answered. Please, go ahead.
Just so we can get it on the record, I've got a couple of problems with the bill, so I'm glad that we're going to hold it over. Madam Chair, I'm going to call my town and thanks and just see what the 150 does, and so I'll be able to report that back. But the question, if we have we're blessed with lots of government in Fairbanks, so we have a home rule city inside a second-class borough. If the city is responsible for the 911, and they want to raise the rate or lower it, who votes to do that? Are the residents of Fairbanks or is it the borough? So maybe we could get some help from someone to tell us how that would work. Maybe the Department of Commerce and Economic Development could tell us how that would work. They could come or at least write us a letter.
Okay, Senator Bundy, do you have any insight into that?
I don't.
Who runs your program?
The city.
The city.
Our city does.
I would speculate the guess is that the vote has to be the subscribers. Now, if the subscribers are just in the city, that would be the vote. If the subscribers are city and borough, that's the guess I would hazard that people who have to vote are the subscribers of that telephone utility. And so whether they're in city or borough doesn't matter.
If I could, then let's, if we don't have an answer today, I'm going to talk with Fairbanks about the bill. Let's see if they have, maybe they have an answer. If not, I'll ask Mayor Thompson if he could find that answer or we'll bird dog it from our office or perhaps somebody online.
One of our guys back here is shaking his head like he knows what he's talking about. Do you want to come testify, please? You with red shirt? Yes, you. He has that look of knowledge. I know he's from Anchorage. You'd introduce yourself and give your title, please.
Yes, Madam Chair. Me with the red shirt.
Yeah.
Lieutenant Stephen Heavy with the Anchorage Police Department. We don't really have that big a dog in this fight as far as the municipality goes with the borough issue, but I would agree with Senator Bundy. What would be fair is whoever is going to be assessed that. So if you're assessing a surcharge on borough-wide, then I would say you're going to have to go borough-wide to get a vote of those people. Otherwise, if you're going with just the city folk and then you're also going to raise the surcharge on the borough people, you're essentially raising their surcharge and they didn't get a voice in it. So the answer to the question for the senator would be, I think you go for everybody that would be paying it, votes.
Anyone that's in that telephone service area?
Yes, sir.
And not just residents of the city of Fairbanks?
Correct. Anybody that you're going to raise that surcharge on should vote on it.
Okay. And then I know that someone sent the suggestion up that we ask Tim Rogers, because he may have an answer to that as well. Okay?
Yeah.
And would you, anything else to ask of Steve?
No.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
I know.
Thank you very much. Tim Rogers, do you have any insight on that? Tim Rogers, are you still online? Okay. Tim Rogers is not there. Go ahead, Tim?
Yes.
Okay. Did you hear the question that was asked?
Yes, I did. I'm not an expert on that particular area, but I would concur with Lieutenant Heavy that probably should be the service area of the that the telephone subscribers.
Thank you very much. Senator Wilkin.
Chair, why don't you, with Senator Bundy's permission and yours, why don't you let us bird dog that, and we'll bring an answer back to the table.
Okay. I know, as I recall, that was the point of the Fairbanks discussion last year, and that they were either having difficulty or the explanation for charging the full area that they served. And so you may want to talk to them again, like you suggested you would. So, Senator Bundy.
And for what it's worth, it was this legislator's intent that when the language was drafted to allow that combination of flexibility for the municipality and protection from the municipality, that the people who would be assessed, the people in the service area, are the ones that would be allowed to vote. So if there's legally other divisions of that vote, we need to find out. Thanks.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Oh, we also have Chuck Kopp online. Chuck, would you like to give your testimony?
Madam Chair, thank you. Just briefly, in 1985, we had three home rule cities, Kenai, Homer, Seward, and one first-class city, Soldotna, all having 911 programs. Those were supported just by residences of the city. Then, at that time, all four cities gave their 911 call-taking authority to our first-class borough. At that point, we became a borough-wide authority, and then all borough-wide residents paid the surcharge. So that helps clarify. If you have a city like Fairbanks who is agreeing to run it for an entire borough, then still you'd have all borough people voting. Basically, like Lieutenant Steve Hebby said, if you're a user of place, but here on the peninsula, just historically, we used to have four cities running programs, and to keep the system from being fragmented, we went to one borough-wide system. It required the home rule and first-class cities give that power to the borough, which they can by the last constitution, and we did that, and now we have a borough-wide authority, so that's worked out a lot better for us. Secondly, I just wanted to thank the Senate Finance Committee for wrestling through this. There's been a number of and Nina, as a board, has worked on this for the past 2 years with these issues, and I am very supportive of moving this bill forward. We have an underfunded system, which I don't iterate. Bill Doolittle's comments were right on the money as far as the possibility of setting up some type of program management language that would indicate that every municipality or borough has a 911 authority must have a program documented that explains how the program is managed, over the program and reimbursement method. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chuck. Are there any questions for Chuck Kopp? Also here today to testify is, or in the room, who has not signed up to testify, but signed up. Walt Monaghan, did you wish to testify?
Just be minute,
come right ahead.
Thank you. My name is Walt Monaghan. I'm the Anchorage Police Chief. It is the Anchorage Police Department that runs the municipality of Anchorage PSAP. In fact, it was Lieutenant Hebby that was up here earlier, who was the commander of that unit, so they put a lot of value in him as well. What I would like to do first off is say I appreciate the efforts that the Senate is doing to address the issues in regards to the surcharge. And we do support this bill in that every dollar that we are currently now using to subsidize a shortfall can be reallocated to its proper duties. So overall, the passage of this bill and allowing us to increase the surcharge will effectively enhance all public safety in the efforts within our municipality.
Any questions for Walt Monaghan? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. As we looked at some of the discussion that's happened so far, it's gone from $2 down to $1.50. What's your thoughts on that?
Candidly, I would prefer $2 because it doesn't mean that we're going to jump right to it right off the get-go, but it gives us a lot more breathing room in the years that we before have to run into the expense of having an election. it would allow us more time.
Is there going to be significant, a significant decrease in service because of the 50 cent difference?
Not at this point, no.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Hoffman, don't you have any questions for this man?
We already had our discussion.
Did you announce conflicts and all those things? With the
yes.
He owes me a CDs, Madam
Thank
Chair.
You very much. Any other questions for Walt? Thank you for being here. It's a pleasure. John Fillingwater?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm John Fillingwater, the fire chief of the municipality of Anchorage, and I don't have a cousin on this committee, so I do have a couple of close friends, however.
You abandoned.
I'm sorry. I moved to South Anchorage, what can I say? Question Con Bundy's appreciation, I think. We've talked a lot about the language of the bill and some of the fixes, I think, that need to occur. Generally, however, Walt speaks for me as well. We're happy with the bill as written. Obviously, there could be some changes made that would make it a little more palatable from the borough standpoint, and I think I appreciate that. I think what Steve Hebe was trying to say is that we don't have a dog in that fight, and certainly we don't. I'd like to just maybe say this, that we're here because of the public safety issue. We're here because when people call 911, they anticipate somebody's going to answer. They anticipate they will go to the right location, regardless of whether it's a hardwire phone, wired line phone, or now a cell phone in the Anchorage area. So that's what this legislation is all about. It's the ability to turn the switch on so we can find you or somebody else that has a cell phone and go forward with that area. This Anchorage is first. I guess we've assumed the role of being the first to particularly on the wireless issue. But Fairbanks, Nome, Kenai, Juneau are right behind us. So we would appreciate your support. And Madam Chairman, I think probably I've said enough.
Thank you, John. Any questions for John Fullenweider? Thank you for being here. We appreciate your testimony. Because of some of the questions that Bill Doolittle raised, if I could request anyone who's interested in working on that revised language to join Kim. And anyone's invited. It's not a closed-door meeting, and I would certainly expect Senator Bundy's staff to join that conversation and anyone else who's interested. And if we can get that revised language during this session, we'll bring it back and submit the amendment. Senator Bundy, Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there anyone from the state troopers to ask to answer how their system works statewide?
Are the Alaska State Troopers here? Is anyone here able? Stan, you want to come forward and give us the word on that, please?
Good morning. For the record, my name is Stan Herrera. I'm the Director for the Enterprise Technology Services Division under the Department of Administration. Our role here with 911 is kind of twofold. One is that the establishment of a 911 coordinator for the state kind of resides within the Department of Administration, and from legislation late last year, also within the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. We are working as our role in that 911 coordinator is to ensure compliance with the law or the statutes that are established for 911, the collection of surcharges, and compliance of the terms of within the legislation. The Alaska State Troopers, Commissioner Tandesky, has voiced a concern about the effects of the collection of 911 surcharges, specific, I believe, to the Mat-Su Borough, and how that affects the PSAP and where the Alaska State Troopers, what their role is in that, and the difference of who's actually collecting, who's actually getting the funds versus who's having to provide the services. So that is kind of a twofold role that we're playing. Daryl Davis is online as well. I would encourage Daryl to participate with Kim in this offline session to address the issues that the Department of Public Safety may or may not have in this.
Thank you. Does that answer your question, Senator Hoffman?
Well, not exactly. What I'm wondering is, obviously, the 911 system has to be operating 24 hours a day. Mm-hmm. And in rural areas of the state, any place in the state, whether they call from Arctic Village or McCoyuk or any place to get a hold of the state troopers, how is that whole program, I'm wondering, how is that whole program manned and how is that program funded? And if we can get some answers from the troopers, I'd appreciate that.
Okay. Get in touch with them. Okay. Any questions for Stan? Thank you, Stan. We'll see if we can get that information from the troopers. Senator Wilkin, do you want to withdraw your motion for us to review?
Let's see, Madam Chair, move and ask unanimous consent that I withdraw the motion to consider version S.
Yes, thank you, thank you. Is there objection? Okay, we will, if anyone who's interested in that possible solution for the two items that the City of Anchorage brought up, and they'll gather, I guess, back here in my office is fine. And then anyone is welcome to go in. It's certainly open for all. So if you'd like to go in and have that discussion, please just go through this door. And as long did you want to come join, Kim? And then we will just set that aside to now and see if we can get resolution on that and then get the further information we need. Oh my goodness. Bring in the chairs. Good. Okay, the next item we have up today is Senate Bill 88, Policy on General Fund Revenue Shortfall. Senator Wilkin, are we ready?
Yes, we are.
Oh, sorry, I was supposed to do 151 first, Senator Wilkins.
There.
Are you there? Okay, Senate Bill 151, and who's carrying that bill? Okay, Senate Bill 151 is a decoupling from the federal tax deduction regarding the Alaska net income tax. Dan, welcome. Chuck.
Welcome, Senator.
And you are carrying the bill today for the governor's office, for the administration?
Madam Chairman, I am. My name is Dan Dickinson. I'm Director of Tax in the Department of Revenue. And we'd like to spend a couple of minutes and talk to you about SB 151. I think
this
you have
is a nice, brief bill. My goodness, after the 94-page bill we've been going through, this is a pleasure.
I won't go through it word by word.
Thank you. Don't read it to us, okay? Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I believe you have some packets that have some additional information. We made up for the brevity of the bill with lots of lots of additional paper. And what I'd like to do is basically give you a quick overview. There's a new federal law, which was passed at the end of last year, and beginning in 2005, taxpayers may now exclude a portion of their what's called their Qualified Production Activity Income, or QPAI. And QPAI is any income from extraction, production, or manufacturing in the United States. There's a long history, which I won't get into, about the U.S. trying to conform its trade laws to the WTO, but this is an attempt for the U.S. Congress to advantage these kind of activities, extraction, production, manufacturing, that occur in the United States relative to those activities occurring abroad. Affected industries in Alaska, oil and gas, both production, refinery and marketing, construction industry, fishing and fish processing, mining, all of those are affected industries. In 2005, the first year of the law, an industry is allowed a 3% deduction, or a deduction of 3% of their QPAI, and that number is going to rise up over a number of years to 9% in 2010. Now, what I want to make clear is this is not some new activity. This is, the company is going to do exactly what it did before. It's just under the tax law, when it goes to calculate how much taxable income there is, it's allowed to take a certain amount of income and deduct it or exclude it from that calculation. So the company is going to do exactly what it did before. Simply, the taxable income is going to decrease. What does that mean for Alaska? Well, I think, as you know, we adopt the federal tax code by reference. In other words, we start, the way a taxpayer pays their tax is they go through all the federal tax rules, which are also now the Alaska tax rules, figure out their income, their gross income, and then to pay their federal tax, they figure out how much of that income is taxable, is Alaska taxable income, through a set of formulas, and that's what we tax. Let's say it comes out to 10%, then we go back, we say, what's their worldwide or their U.S. income? 10% of that's Alaskan, so we take 10% over, and then take the 9.4% of that. In other words, what's going to happen is that pool that we start with is going to decrease someplace between 3 and 10%, depending on what year it's in. Now, the state has the option to decouple from federal law, and we have. For example, we use different depreciation deductions. Back in the early 80s when folks started and went through the, first there was accelerated cost recovery system, ACRES, and then there's MACRS, which is the modified accelerated cost recovery system. The state has not adopted those. So we still have the same federal rules that were in place in 1980. We simply haven't adopted those. And we can do that with this as well. The impact to Alaska, if nothing is done, is going to be more dramatic compared with most states. And that's because natural resources, of course, form the basis of our taxable income, and there's almost no, essentially, service industry income in our tax base. So we simply are going to be hit more heavily than most taxes. Now, than most states. Alaska can't essentially look at what the feds did and do the same thing for Alaska. In other words, what the feds have done is set up a rule that says, gee, if you do this activity within the U.S., we'll lower your taxes. If it goes up outside the U.S., it won't lower your taxes. Now, if the state of Alaska could say, hey, if you do the activity in the state of Alaska, we'll lower your taxes, and if you do the activity outside the state of Alaska, it won't lower your taxes, that might be a very different conclusion. We might come to a very different conclusion. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you believe the state should relate to the rest of the United States, we're not allowed to do that. We can't pass a law that says an activity in Alaska should have a different effect than if the taxpayer chooses to do that same thing in Indiana or Louisiana. So we can't draw the same line about inside Alaska and outside Alaska that the feds can for inside the United States and outside the United States. What would the effect of this law have been? If you look back in the last year when we can calculate it fairly precisely, and you assume we were at the full 9% deduction, we would have received between 24.7 and 27.4 million less in revenue in FY 2004.
What are those numbers again?
They're in the packet here, and the number is 24.7 to 27.4 million less. Now that's at the full 9%. As we look forward in this fiscal year, it's going to be considerably less than that, and it'll be growing each year as you go out. And if you look in your packet, there's the projected revenue loss is on the second page of that, and it kind of goes through each year and tells you the range of figures that we expect to see. The bottom line of that is over the next decade, $100 million less in corporate income tax revenues as a consequence of this being passed through. I'd like to make a couple of observations about this. The federal tax and economic policy goals that are articulated by the federal government, as I said, cannot be replicated by the state government. There's another twist that makes that even worse, and that is, not to get too far into the details here, but when we look at corporations, oil and gas corporations, we look at their worldwide income, not at their U.S. income. So we have to go and create and look at worldwide the deductions that they'd be liable to. And we believe that we would have to allow QPAI-like deductions for activities done in, say, Nigeria or Azerbaijan or someplace outside of the United States. In other words, we can't draw that line between U.S. And interior to U.S. and exterior to the U.S. the way the federal government can. Now, when we audit a large multinational oil company, we rely on the feds to do 95% of the work. In other words, we don't audit anything that the feds are also going to audit. The only things we look at is how have they attributed that income to Alaska, or how have they dealt with special rules that we have just for Alaska. What would happen if the QPAI deduction is still allowed is the feds aren't going to audit that, the construction of that activity for Nigeria or some, I'm going to pick on Nigeria each time as that country comes to my head here, but activity outside of the United States. And so we would have to audit that, or else not audit it, ignore it. But I guess the notion I'd like to make here, and we didn't quite know how to put this in the fiscal note, we mentioned this, but it's almost like a negative fiscal note, in the sense that if the bill doesn't pass and we're faced with a whole new area in which we have to audit without the support of the IRS, we're going to need more resources to do it. If the bill does pass, it will stop the need for us to do that work. When I talked to the governor about this, his quick reaction to this was, it's a federal mandate. It's another unfunded federal mandate. Basically, the feds have passed a law. It has desirable policy goals for the federal government. Now, as it affects the state, we can make that even more beneficial to the taxpayers if we want to fund that. But the point is, the feds have made this decision, and the state now, unlike most unfunded federal mandates, has the option to either participate or not participate. So I want to make one thing very clear about this. If the state decouples for state taxes, we are not making any changes to the benefits that taxpayers receive when they file their federal income taxes. That's between them and the federal government, and those rules are set. What we do has no effect on that. Where what we do is affected by is they then take their filing with the federal government and use that as the basis for their state filing. So we can either accept the notion of an unfunded federal mandate and say, okay, that's going to drop as well, or we can say, no, we believe it's appropriate for things to remain as they were, for us not to accept this decrease, and we'll simply take one section of the Internal Revenue Code and say that section does not apply. I can go through very briefly the things that are in your packet. I think as the Madam Chairman observed, the bill itself is very short. It just says that section won't apply. We'll have to create some transitional rules to make sure that estimated payments don't get bollocked up. But what I have here in your packet makes up for the brevity of that bill. The first package is just talks about the American Jobs Creation Act of 2004. And one of the interesting things about that is, you know, that if you look down the first sort of third paragraph down, it talks about the new deduction. And then you'll see about a four or five paragraph description of what that deduction does. And then this goes through and lists the other pieces, the other parts and pieces that were in the federal law, which now will become part of Alaska state law. So you'll know there's now be a, under Alaska state law, there'll be a change in how long it takes to recover racetrack improvements. All kinds of things like that, they're gonna flow through. But what we're focusing on is this new deduction and suggesting that it not be appropriate to flow that through. The second thing in the package is a 24-page report, tax notes special report. It kind of tells companies how they can best deal with this, all the various aspects. And again, I suggest if you want to just flip through it and look at some of the paragraphs and then thank me for not trying to go into the details of the bill, that'd probably be the appropriate response for looking at that. And finally, the final thing in the package is a brochure that I get. I think folks are aware, as a CPA, we have a requirement for a continuing professional education, so I get all these brochures. And this one says, we can go off to either Minneapolis or New York and learn how to maximize the U.S. tax benefits on domestic production activities. And what I think is appropriate to go through here, and you can read through the agenda and all the things that are going to be there, and think about how many of those, and the kinds of issues that are being raised there you think would be appropriate for us to be focusing on, or for the state of Alaska, if those kind of distinctions are ones that should be advantaged in the Alaska tax code. And that's the brief overview. If folks have technical questions about it, Chuck is Chuck Harlemer here, the operations manager in the Department of Revenue Tax, will be much better answering them than I will, but I'll certainly give a shot too, if I might.
Thank you, Dan. Questions for Mr. Dickinson? Senator Stedman?
I got several. I'm not so sure this is as simple of an issue as being stated, and maybe as we go through this, you'll convince me of that. My understanding is we're going to include all industries except for domestic production activities. Are we going to exclude the entire issue? In other words, are we just including oil and gas, or are we including, excluding oil and gas, or excluding everybody?
Senator Stedman, through the chair, we are not picking out any industry in particular. Oil and gas would be treated the same as fishing, as would be the same as construction. Now, clearly, in our tax system, oil and gas industry is paying the majority of the dollars.
I understand.
They will be affected by it, but we're not making any distinctions within the legislation.
Explain again, if I could, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Can you explain again, and let's not go into the phase-in, but just explain again this 9% reduction on regular income or taxable income, and the effect it has on any loss carry forward or gain carry forward that may or may not be in place for a particular filer.
Thank you, Senator. Let me take the first part, and then maybe Chuck can deal with the second part. Or the first part of the question is, company is going to calculate their taxable income just kind of how you normally think about it. You take your revenues, you subtract your expenses, your taxable expenses. Then you can now take an added deduction before arriving at your taxable income, which is going to be the lower of 9% of the income that you derived from qualified production activity. So you have to go back and go through your whole tax return or figure out what was service versus QPAI. But once you figure out all the income that you derive from qualified production activity, you take 9% of that, and that now becomes an additional allowable deduction. So in some sense, there are certain expenses which are going to be treated, allowed to be deducted twice, essentially. Now, that's also limited by 50% of your W-2 wages.
Is there a provision, and I think you mentioned it, to use the accelerated cost recovery system, which, for those people that aren't familiar with the ACRS, it's a way to take your depreciation schedule from 30 years down to 15 or 35 to 15 or whatever numbers you happen to work, compress that to increase the deduction. Is that also included in this in any form? Or?
Senator, no. That we will continue to use the older, longer schedules. That's currently part of Alaska law, and it's not anticipated that will change. The only thing that was changed specifically in this bill was, for example, in relation to a gas project, an accelerated depreciation was built in for an Alaska gas plant for federal purposes, but under Alaska law, we would continue to use the extended period.
I mean, if we do not pass this legislation, proposed legislation, and we adopt the changes out of Washington, now, will the industry have access to an ACRS schedule versus a straight line?
Will they what?
Have access to an accelerated cost recovery system, a shorter depreciation schedule.
Senator Stedman, through the chair, neither passing this legislation or rejecting it would give them access to that.
Any other questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. As we look at the reason for the federal law that was there, was going to create jobs, obviously, Do you not think the same effect will happen here in the state, whether you decouple or don't decouple?
Senator, through the chair, the purpose of the law was to create jobs in the United States, and we have no sense that you'll bring jobs preferentially to Alaska. Mm-hmm. And the reason you create jobs in the United States is you'll draw a line around that says, tax advantage if you create the jobs here, not tax advantage if you create the jobs there. Now, Alaska's sitting here, and we can't draw that same line.
I see.
And so, I'm not doubting at all that people were very sincere in trying to create jobs in the United States and that these economic tools will do that. Point is, it doesn't help Alaska at all because the jobs don't necessarily come here.
And one more question, Madam Chairman, if I could. As we look at the $100 million, that's over a 10-year period, that's $10 million a year. What's it going to cost to go ahead and implement this statute that we're looking at? And who's going to bear that cost?
Senator Olson, through the chair, we believe there will be no additional cost for implementing this statute. The additional cost will come about if we don't implement this. In other words, if we implement this statute, then we won't have to go do any QPAI deductions, deduction auditing. If we don't implement this statute, then we'll have to go audit QPAI-like activities that occur outside of the United States. So,
thank you, Madam Chairman.
Senator Bundy.
Thank you. We have an indeterminate fiscal note from revenue, yet I've heard, we don't do this, it's round numbers, $25 million. In opposition to each other, the indeterminate to $25 million. Could you address that?
Certainly, Senator Bundy, through the chair. The specific numbers we have refer to FY 2004, which was a very high tax. We've got a lot of taxable income, and I can have my book here, but that was a very high year. If you look at what's happening in the future as oil prices fall and for various other activities, that's why it's falling off. That was at the full 9%. The first several years would only be at 3%. In other words, if you look at the table here, what you'll see is in the early years, we're looking at a loss of about $5 to $6 million. Out in 2013, we're looking at a loss of $15 to $16 million. And the 25 would be just, if in fact we have a set of circumstances that produce the kind of situation we had in FY 2004, then we could have numbers in that range again.
Thank you.
Now, Mr. Senator Bundy, that is a little misleading because I think that's what you asked to reference page 2, and they just have the whole paragraph, four paragraphs plus some numbers added on the second page, which replaces the information on the front of the fiscal note, I assume. Is that what it is? Yeah. Are there any other questions for the gentleman?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Stedman.
I will apologize. I haven't had time to read the 60-page report or whatever it is here from Deloitte & Touche. Does this affect, if I understand you correctly, we're going to opt out entirely of this economic stimulus concept coming out of Washington. Does this affect the subchapter S corporations and how they're compiled or limited? Encountered in dealing with family members?
Senator Stedman, through the chair, let me make clear, we're only opting out of one piece of the stimulus package. I mean, Chuck, how many pages is the bill? Is like yay thick and we're opting out of six pages of it? Sorry.
For the record, my name is Chuck Harlan. I'm with the Alaska Department of Revenue. And through the chair, the explanation that I use to reference this bill is this thick, very fine print. But this is a major piece of that tax reform or the American Jobs Creation Act of 2004. This piece has no impact on the treatment of S corps under Alaska law. And so it will basically the effect of this bill will be to reverse in your Alaska tax return one line item on your federal tax return. That's in other deductions. and only corporations who pay tax now will be affected. S-corps will not.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, I'm just curious. Well, under what are these two scenarios, the current scenario or the scenario where we adopt this legislation and repeal certain portions of the legislation come out of Washington, would best position the state of Alaska to encourage the development of refineries and other large capital projects from the corporate standpoint and then from the state standpoint?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, I'm not aware of anything in that federal act in total. I'm sure that's there. That is an incentive for building a refinery, for example, in Alaska. There's clearly an incentive for building a refinery somewhere in the U.S., but whether one of our taxpayers or any other company builds a refinery in Alaska or in Texas or wherever, the same tax benefit will flow to that company if we don't except from the federal law. The same Alaska tax benefit will float. So it's hard to say that there is any transfer of incentive to do business in Alaska, because there's no difference between doing business in Alaska and anywhere else in the end result.
May I rephrase the question?
Go ahead and restate.
Mm-hmm. Assume Texas, because it came up. Assume, you know, or some other state does not opt out. In Alaska, we pass this legislation and we opt out. Everything else being equal, who's going to be in the best position to encourage and secure the development of refineries?
Watch it.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, that would depend on, of course, the mix of economic factors, including taxation, that exists in either state. If we were to isolate it, you know, all our levers being the same, and our initial tax structure being the same, those of course aren't true. But if you were to make those assumptions, Texas was to adopt this bill, and by the way, Texas doesn't have the same income tax we do, so it's not going to apply the same way there. But assume they did, had the same exact law we did. And Texas adopted this, or accepted the federal statute, and we accepted from it. The impact would be the tax rate for a refiner, the state tax rate, would be lower in Texas than in Alaska. But it would not be because they did business in Texas. It's because they, not because they put that refinery in Texas. They could have put that refinery in Alaska and got the same exact result in Texas in terms of their mm-hmm. tax. And the opposite is true. So you could argue it's hard to find an incentive there when wherever you put that refinery achieves the same result under the state tax law.
Madam Chair, I was just using that as an example, because what I think a lot of us would like to do is encourage some economic development in the state and create some employment, especially for the next generation. And I don't want to see the state in a disadvantage compared to an advantage. I've got some more questions, but
Senator Bundy has a question. So, Senator Bundy.
Doesn't require immediate answer. I was just wondering if we have any of the taxpayers to testify.
I've not had anyone sign up to testify so far.
Maybe an indication of awareness or a lack of concern, and I doubt they're unaware.
Senator Stedman, you want to continue?
What I'd like us to do is hold a bill so I can have a
conversation. Sure, we'll hold the bill. We'll hold it, because I think there may be questions. Yes, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. As I look at your third page here, and look at, I'm assuming that the status of QPAI in other states, I'm assuming what you want to do is move us from column 3 over to column 1. Is that correct?
Through column two, yes, that's exactly correct, Senator. Through the chair.
To column two, you said?
No, through column two to column one.
To column one. But I don't see any of those states that are in that column the same type of states that we are, in that we are an oil-producing state. We've got our personal income tax situation here, as well as some other unique things that we have here in Alaska. In fact, I see the oil-producing states remaining in column three. You got Oklahoma, Louisiana. I actually looked for Texas, but you already answered that or alluded to that, the reason it's not there. If they haven't seen the wisdom in moving over, why would we want to be like Arkansas or California?
Through the chair, Senator Olson. First of all, this is a voluntary response to a survey put on by the FTA, so it's not all inclusive and it's not up to date. One issue is that we, I believe, stand alone in the nation for applying worldwide combined reporting to oil and gas companies, or to our major, certainly to an industry that represents 80% of our tax base. So I do not believe there's another state where the implications of the bill as applied at the state level are as dramatic as they are in Alaska. There is always a good, there's always a good argument for staying in conformity with federal law. Mm-hmm. It keeps things simple. Generally, you don't want to generate minor timing differences that generate headaches for taxpayers and the state for years to come. But on the other hand, we end up with this is not a timing difference, it's a permanent difference, meaning we'll never recoup this revenue once it's gone, and it's, for Alaska, more dramatic than you'll see with other states. I can't answer for the, all the states you were referring to are also states that automatically adopt the federal law just like we do. And so the inertia is obviously to stand pat. It takes an effort to come forth and change it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Senator Olson, through the chair, if I might just add
one
other observation, and I don't know the status of what's happening in North Virginia and West Dakota, North Dakota and West Virginia, I guess, more traditionally put, but I believe those could both be considered resource states that would be, in a similar, maybe not precisely the same, but at least a similar situation in some aspects.
Okay, thank you.
In Montana, excuse me.
I think Arkansas would be, actually, because they are, what is it, land of the resources? There's mining, minerals. I don't know if there's that much oil, but. Are there any other questions? Any other information you want to share with us today?
Madam Chairman, we'd be pleased to talk through any specifics or to work with Senator Stedman and make sure
great.
That the questions,
if you could visit
we have
with
no
him
other
him.
Things we'd...
Okay. Is there anyone in the room who wishes to testify? We will bring this bill back up at a later date, and maybe we'll get all the questions answered and see what we can do. Thank you very much. We'll take a brief at ease.